Right, thanks very much for the invitation, and I enjoyed listening to the talks very much. So I'm from the atomic physics community, working on interface between quantum many-body systems, atomic physics, and quantum information. So I think that most of the audience here are from condensed matter background. So if I am using too much jargons that you are not familiar with, please feel free to stop. And feel free to ask any basic questions. So what I'm going to talk about in the next half an hour is our effort to build a quantum simulator based on laser-cooled trapped atomic ion. So I joined Institute for Quantum Computing, which is part of a collaboration between different institutes at physics and astronomy. This is my home department at the University of Waterloo, and I'm building a laboratory there. So we have listen to several very interesting talks on different kinds of materials. That some of them, like most of them, are some kind of interesting material. They have strong correlations between them. Now, these strongly correlated systems don't necessarily mean that they have to be condensed matter. In high energy physics, you can have a very strongly interacting particles. So, for example, in this collider, heavy ion collider experiment, you can have quark gluon plasma. They interact very strongly, all the quarks. So some of the problems of modern physics involve understanding the microscopic description of what's the simplest model I can write down of this kind of macroscopic observation. On the other hand, I can take the same problem and basically turn it upside down. So imagine I know everything about some spins, right? The two-level system spins. I know everything about how one single spin behaves. In fact, I know everything about how pairs of spins behave. And what happens if I put a bunch of them together? So these are quantum systems. Can I predict what macroscopic spin quantum phase I'm going to get as they interact pairwise? We can also talk about individual atoms. In the last decade or so, in the cold atom community, we have been able to almost individually manipulate atoms on an optical lattice and in other systems. So if I understand, again, everything about, so I know the Hamiltonian about a single atom or how two atoms interact, when I put together a bunch of them, thousands of them, how what kind of quantum phases they form. So those are some of the basically same question. Of course, there are analytical approximations, analytical methods for very few of these models. So we want to understand them on computer. But the problem is, of course, entanglement, because that's something that's very non-classical. And of course, theorists are trying to come up with more and more sophisticated approximation algorithms. So for example, if you have just two-level systems or spins, you can have entanglement between them. So no matter which basis you try to measure the system at, they are always anti-correlated from X or Y or Z, any basis. And in fact, in quantum many-body systems, it's the growth of entanglement that is a problem when it comes to computing these things in a computer, because you cannot necessarily truncate the Hamiltonian into some simplified approximation. So if you want to do a brute force diagonalization of your Hamiltonian of two-level systems, then essentially our computing speeds run out of the practical application, practical utility, beyond about 30 to 40 spins. Of course, we know that for a large class of quantum Hamiltonians, we can come up with approximate solutions that work very well. So this is not true for all Hamiltonians, but in general, if you want to do a brute force diagonalization. So the one experimental approach to solve this problem is to build so-called quantum simulators. So what we are essentially doing here is manipulating some quantum objects. So here, and I will introduce this system better in a couple of slides. Here we have a bunch of individual atoms. These are atomic ions. They are cooled using atomic physics technique, so laser cooling technique. And they are essentially a zero temperature system. But we can also add noise or disorder in a very controlled way. And within each atomic ion, I can identify two internal states that I can call my spin state. So this becomes a two-level state. Right? And this is the same system that I would be calling a qubit if I were talking to a quantum computation audience. And not only that, In these systems, we also can measure these spin systems individually. So again, I'll be showing the detailed scheme in a few slides. But for example, if this is in spin up, and this will show up as a bright glowing ball on my camera, on my CCD camera in the lab. And if this is down, this will show up as a dark spot. So I can take a, if I am making an antiferromagnetic system, instead of doing indirect measurement, I can just take a snapshot of this system, and I should be seeing up, down, up, down, up, down, meaning bright, dark, bright, dark, bright, dark. So it's a much more direct way of probing this system. So, and once we do that, and this is a quantum system, so we say, okay, let's see what kind of Hamiltonian we can engineer in this, right? And it's a quantum system, so we engineer some kind of Hamiltonian. So for example, here, the transverse field Ising model, which is very rich, it has quantum phase transitions. And we just let the system evolve according to that Hamiltonian. It knows the laws of quantum mechanics. And at some point, we just stop the evolution and we read out the state. And that's how we get the result of, let's say, what's the ground state of this system, or by varying the parameters, what's the phase drag of Hamiltonian. So we had a very beautiful talk in the morning by Chris Hardman, where he applied some tools normally used in quantum computation, quantum information community, namely entanglement and entanglement entropy, to characterize a helium pole. So it's a practical condensed matter systems, but he's using tools from quantum information community. So that prompted me to show you this slide, that even if you look back a couple of decades, these three fields, quantum many-body physics, includes a lot of condensed matter physics, quantum information science, and the traditional atomic physics, they were quite disjoint. But now they are becoming more and more overlapping. And I think the kind of problems that I am interested in belong to this junction between these three fields, where I want to use the atomic physics technique to use some laser-cooled trap atomic ions. And I want to simulate non-trivial models of quantum matter, so non-trivial quantum Hamiltonian. And the resulting states, many-body states that I'm getting, I want to characterize them using tools from quantum information sciences, for example, entanglement. And perhaps we can also contribute to the quantum information science community, because we want to use that entanglement in quantum many-body state as a resource for doing quantum. So that's kind of a broad theme. Of course, it's not true that these atomic systems or trapped ion systems are the only game in town. There are lots of other platforms that people use to build these quantum simulators. So this is the trapped ion system that I'll be talking about in the rest of the talk. But then there are neutral atoms in optical lattices. And then there are some fabricated systems like some superconducting qubits, or some photonic network, and some defect centers, NMR, quantum dots, and there are many, many systems. And right now, because we do not have a working quantum computer yet, these different systems are good for solving different kinds of problems. The quantum simulator is like a special purpose quantum computer that we are using to solve a specific set of problems. But among these systems, the atomic systems have a few special advantages. So first of all, atoms are identical. If I take five copies of ytterbium 171 ion that I'm going to use, they are identical. If I can manage the magnetic field in the lab to a percent level, then to all practical purposes, these are identical quantum objects. That's not the case if you are building a quantum simulator out of, let's say, some solid-state device like quantum dots, because they are embedded in a solid-state environment. So each center is different. So that's a gift from nature. And for the same reason that they are isolated from the environment, they are levitated in vacuum, we see excellent quantum coherence properties. So if you want to study some quantum model, that's essential, of course. And in fact, very recently, people showed that with these trapped ion systems, you can see a qubit coherence of up to 10 minutes. So that's quite macroscopic timescale for an atomic system, where we can do individual operations in microseconds, and the qubits live up to 10 minutes. But then, because these are atomic systems, and people have been developing lots of tools in laser cooling and all, so we can use all those techniques. And for example, cool a system, a a bunch of atoms from 1000 Kelvin to a millikelvin in only a few milliseconds. All we need to do, we do not need a big dilution refrigerator. All we need to just turn on a laser, tune the frequency, and within a few milliseconds, they come to, in fact, the quantum mechanical ground state of some harmonic confinement. And this point is super important here, and I'll try to elaborate a little bit later, which is in these trapped atomic systems, in particular ion-based quantum simulators, we can simulate many different kinds of Hamiltonian. So it's a system where, for example, we can tune the range of the interaction between spins as a continuous knob by just playing with the frequency, by just changing some number on my computer. Effectively, I'm changing the interaction between the spins from, let's say, short range to almost infinite. So that's the kind of knob that we can have here. And finally, two very important properties of the atomic systems are the energy scales involved in the Hamiltonian are typically kilohertz to megahertz. What that means is using our conventional electronics that work very well in that frequency range, we can actually observe quantum dynamics in a very clean way. And at the same time, these ions are isolated from each other by about a micron separation. So that means compared to a solid state material, that's extremely dilute, talking about micron. So I can use a conventional optical microscope and take a picture like this. So these are, I'm looking at the individual atoms using conventional optical techniques. So, all right. So we want to trap a bunch of ions, and ions are charged particles. The particular ion I'm interested in is ytterbium-171. So that's a pretty complicated ion, but I'll show you in the next slide that it's in fact like that. Because these are charged particles, so we have to use an ion trap. An ion trap is essentially a bunch of electrodes where we apply voltages. From our basic electrostatics, we know that Laplace's equation means that we cannot create a three-dimensional potential minimum by using electrostatics alone. So that's why we also have to use some radio frequency. It's a little bit of detail, but quite important detail for these kind of experiments. So end of the day, if we apply our voltages correctly and we can trap from some, you know, atoms inside the vacuum chambers. The whole thing is in a vacuum chamber. And we can have a nice, it's essentially a finite version of a Wigner crystal of ytterbium-171 ion. They're roughly about 2 micron, but we can control that by playing with the voltage from sub-micron to, you know, 20, 30 micron in a very controlled way. Now, I mentioned this, that within the ytterbium, I can also identify some internal states, and I can call them my qubit states for my spin, right? Now, if I look at the energy diagram of ytterbium, I told you it's like hydrogen. It's not, because it's very complicated. It has 171 nucleons, and so it has lots of states, S and P and D and some low-lying F states, and, you know, some states called bracket states. I'm not sure how many people even heard of things like bracket states in atomic systems. But the point is, if we know how to play our lasers correctly, then we can very confidently manipulate all the unwanted states and convert this system into a simple two-level system. And we can have a coherence of up to 10 minutes. So that's the beauty of this atomic physics technique. If we want to initialize, let's say a spin state. So I want to, let's say I have a bunch of spins and I want to polarize them. So instead of applying a large magnetic field as we traditionally do for condensed matter systems, I do it optically. So this is known as optical pumping. What I do is I turn on some laser which is precisely tuned between these atomic states. And from these atomic states, it can spontaneously decay to the spin down state. And once it's in spin down state, then it's stuck because there is no laser that can take it out of the spin down. So after scattering a few photons with very high probability, 99.9%, it can get stuck in spin down. So I make a polarized state in only a few microseconds using lasers. Similarly, I can also detect those states. And for that, what I do is, again, I tune the laser in between some other atomic transition. So if the atom is in up state, it gets excited. And there, a few nanoseconds later, it spontaneously decays to those states. And it can keep doing that because my laser is on. Now, the cool thing is, the transition between this F equals to zero in the P state, atomic state, to F equals to zero in the S state is forbidden. That's one of those, you know, forbidden transitions. So I can repeat this cycle again and again without ever mixing my spin up and spin down. So if my system is in spin up and I keep this 370 nanometer laser light on, then on a photo multiply tube or photo detector, I will collect lots and lots of photons in a short amount. And then I know that my system is in spin up. If my atom is in spin down state, then the same laser, because of this hyperfine splitting of about 12.6 gigahertz, the same laser is now off resonance. It doesn't do anything. So that would show up as on the photomultiplier tube, photo detector, I would say zero count. So it's like a dark. So I can just look at the atom, whether it's bright or dark, and depending on that, I'll know whether my spins are up. So now that I have shown you how to initialize a spin state and how to detect a spin state, let's talk about how to manipulate a spin state. So if I want to manipulate the spin state of a single ion, what I can do, I can bring in a radiation field, and that could be in the form of a microwave, or I can create a beat note from two laser beams, interfering two laser beams, and I tune that frequency of the radiation field to be the frequency of the hyperfine structure, which is my spin state. And that would basically flip the spin. And I can control how fast the spin is precessing, essentially, by controlling the power of this laser beam. So it's like bringing in an external magnetic field, because I'm precessing this. The spins are precessing in the presence of this this laser beam. But still, that does not involve coupling two ions. So next, what I want to do is engineer a Hamiltonian. Or I can also say I want to entangle two ions. So let's say I want to entangle ion number 2 and 6. There is a small interaction because of the magnetic moments of the internal states, atomic states that I'm creating between the ions, but that interaction is very weak, number one. And number two, that's something that we do not know how to turn off. That's just property of the atomic. So that's not the interaction that I'm talking about. The interaction that I'm going to play with, the interaction that we will engineer with some laser forces, I'll show you in a minute, and we have a lot of control. So we can turn off the interaction, we can turn it on, and change things about the interaction. So to do that, let's say we bring in one laser field focused on ion number 2, and instead of tuning the frequency of the radiation field to be just the spin splitting, I do it spin plus a vibration excitation. So these are the phonons of this chain of charged particles, right? So the spin can flip, but at the same time, it will excite a vibrational quantum. And this is like in chemistry, the anti-Stokes process, or in cavity QED, this is like the so-called anti-James Cummings type Hamiltonian. But then I can bring in a second frequency to, let's say, the ion number 6, and I can tune it such that that frequency is the qubit frequency minus that vibrational quantum. Right? So if this vibration, this excitation were not present in the system, that will not do anything because that's an off-resonant process. But because this laser has created one excitation, so it can absorb that, kill that excitation and fit the system. So essentially, I have created an interaction between these two spins by the exchange of one vibration excitation. So the effective Hamiltonian here is taking two spins from down to up. So that's like an Ising model. But the important point here is the coefficient of the Ising model, the interaction, is not necessarily nearest neighbor, because we are not relying on the natural overlap like in a conventional electron, where we are engineering this interaction by this phonon type interaction, phonon mode. So if we look at the interaction strength between ion I and j, since I and j, I mean, let's not go into detail about all the terms here, but I think quite intuitive that the interaction will depend on the laser power, how strongly I'm driving those systems, right? So there is a term which depends on the laser power, the driving frequency, and then the mass of the ion and Planck's constant and the momentum that the radiation field imparts onto the ion, which essentially shakes it, excites into the vibrational state that goes into it. That's like the fundamental recoil frequency for these systems, can't do anything about it. But then there is this very important term here, which is essentially how this individual spin took part in the vibration excitation that I have created in order to engineer this interaction. So that's the eigenfunction of different modes and how different ions interact with that eigenfunction. Yes. That's correct. That is correct. And I'll show you in the next slide. That's correct. And then this mu is the frequency of my laser beam, and this omega k are those eigenfrequencies of the phonon mode. So if I bring in, so let's say I have again those, you know, 9 ions here, and I bring in 2 laser beams, and I keep the laser from the left peak, and I just change the frequency of the right laser beam, right? And I scan that frequency. So this is a cartoon. This is not experimental data, but this is something that we expect. If the difference between the frequency matches the hyperfine splitting, then I will just split the spin without touching the motion. If the difference hits any other hyperfine splitting plus all the other motional modes, then I will be exciting different normal modes of hyperfine. And it's a Coulomb system. So these modes, let me show you a couple of pictures. For the axial modes, where the ions are vibrating in the axial direction, the highest frequency mode is the zigzag mode, so the short spatial wavelength. And the lowest frequency is the center of mass mode, where they're all moving together. But in the transverse direction, those are high energy phonons. The center of mass mode is actually the highest frequency. The zigzag mode, the shortest spatial wavelength, is the lowest frequency. So let's say now focus on only this transverse mode, so 9 transverse modes for 9 ions. And these 2 laser beams that I showed earlier, one creating an excitation and one destroying an excitation, so those are represented by the 2 dots. So if I choose my laser frequency close to the center of mass mode, now one thing you notice is that in the center of mass mode, there is, no concept of separation between the ions, because all the ions are taking part together, right? So if you are exciting only the center of mass mode, then the interaction between the ions should, in fact, be an infinite range interaction. If you detune it slightly away from the center of mass mode, then all the other modes also contribute a little bit. So you have kind of a power law decay of interaction between the ions. And if you go between other modes, then you start to see the eigenfunctions of those modes. So for example, between second and third mode, you have an interaction which is antiferromagnetic in the long range, but ferromagnetic in the short range. And similarly, lots of other types of interactions. So this is an interaction between spin ions. And a lot of experiments have already been done on the close to the center of mass mode, where you can show that by just playing with the frequency of your laser beam, you can tune the range of interaction continuously between a dipole-dipole kind of interaction, so 1 over r cubed, to an infinite range interaction, so 1 over r to the 0. So with that, you can think of lots of different kinds of experiments. So one popular lots of experiments have been done is this adiabatic quantum simulation protocol. Okay? So let's say I want to find out the ground state of the Hamiltonian for some magnetic field, so this is a transverse magnetic field and some Hamiltonian. So I turn on, at time zero, I turn on a large magnetic field, at the same time polarizing the spins along y, and then I adiabatically turn the magnetic field down and stop at some value, and then read off the spin. So if I do it slow enough, then my spin ordering should follow the ground state of the Hamiltonian. So show you one specific example. Let's say it's a long-range interaction, roughly 1 over r, and when the magnetic field is much larger than the average of this Ising coupling, looking at the correlation between the one chosen spin, the left spin, and all others, is roughly zero, because my spins are polarized along y direction, I'm measuring along x direction. And as I'm adiabatically switching the magnetic field down, I start to see this zigzag correlation. So this is a long range, but the ground state is still the nail order, the antiferromagnetic. In fact, I can do much more, because I can repeat the experiment thousands of times and take pictures at each shot, and from that I can sort out how many times I got all up, how many times I got this up, down, up, down, up, down, down, up, down, up, down, up. I can plot a histogram of all 2 to the 10, for this is a 10 particle. And in fact, you see that the red plot is when, for the paramagnet state, when the system is polarized along y, so the population in all 10 to the, all 10, 24 states are roughly even with some flux. But when the magnetic field goes down, you see these 2 tall plateaus. And these are only 2 individual microstates out of 10, 24. Right? Look at those. Those are the nail states. And in fact, you see some other tall states. Those are some of the states, low-lying excitations. So they will have the like the domains, things like that. OK. So I give you I have only like 2 minutes left, so I'll give you a quick, just a flash of some of the very impressive experiments that have been done in this field. Because this is a long-range interaction, some of the very basic questions, concepts that we take for granted don't hold. So for example, let's say we flip a spin or create some excitation in the spin system, and I ask, how does that information propagate? So usually in our nearest neighbor kind of picture, there is a light cone that propagates. So finite speed, there is a bound called Lieb-Robinson bound. Those things don't hold, those concepts for this long-range interaction. So there are some very impressive work here. And also, even though the system is so nice and in a very closed system, you can add either dissipation or disorder or both in a very controlled way. So people have done that, adding disorder, still a closed system, and observe something like a many-body localized state here. And then you can vary all the parameters with time by essentially modulating the intensity of the laser time. And very recently, they have found that in a many-body localized state where you are driving the system periodically due to the interaction, there is a new kind of discrete time crystal phase showing up in this small. So these are all small systems limited to about 20, 25, 30 kind of particles. But still, we see some hint of this few-body, small many-body systems. Another thing you can do with these systems is you can use these two-particle interactions and concatenate them in such a way that the effective Hamiltonian becomes like a multi-spin operator. So for example, in this paper, they showed that you can generate an effective six-spin operator here. So this is my final thought here. So in my research, of course, we'd like to explore a lot of that physics, but another kind of quantum information angle that I'm trying to bring in here is asking this simple question. Let's say I have a bunch of spins, like some nine spins again. And how much control I can have over this spin? Can I go to a situation, can I make an experimental system where a theorist can just tell me what the interaction metric he or she wants from me, and I should be able to create that in the experiment? So that's very hard. So for that, you need more than just the frequency knob of these lasers. You need to control the system at the level of individual ions, and you can also you also have to address the individual phonon in a deterministic. So that's something that I will be building up. So essentially, a cartoon would be from a linear chain of 25, I manipulate the interactions in such a way that the interaction graph essentially looks like a 2D lattice. Or from, if I have 36 ions, it looks like this, a Kagome lattice. So it's a reconfigurable lattice on way because I can manipulate the interaction. And again, that requires control at the level of individual atom, which has been done recently. There are a few approaches. So very recently in Chris Monroe's group at Maryland, they showed a 5-qubit quantum computer where essentially what they have done is used this device called multi-channel acoustophic modulator, where they bring in a focused light, which you can move it around essentially, or a couple of focused lights on individual ions. So you can individually address ions, and you can get the control that was impossible to do even a few years back. So in the morning, we heard about entanglement entropy again, and I was a part of that experiment. And we could measure this entanglement entropy precisely because for the first time, we managed to get control of this whole atomic system at the level of single particle. And that was done using a holographic setup. So the idea is instead of focusing a beam and focusing it on an individual ion, you create an arbitrary pattern. So if you have 10 ions, you specify what's the relative intensity that you want to address on each ion. And you have a big Gaussian beam coming from a laser. You engineer the wavefront such that after it gets Fourier transformed by a lens, it forms precisely the pattern that you want. So if you want to do that, you at the level of atomic precision, then you can do lots of fascinating experiments. So you can create any kind of beam. So these are different beam shapes that you can create. Let me just skip. So with that, I hope I convinced you that this trapped ion quantum simulator is a very versatile system because it lets you engineer lots of different Hamiltonians. So we can ask lots of questions relevant in quantum information and quantum many-body physics. I showed you only quantum Ising model, but we can as well simulate XY model, Heisenberg model, many other kinds of model. And then we, because of the detection scheme, we can look at the spin excitations. I haven't talked about how to measure entanglement. That's something we can do in this system. Look at kind of baby version of quantum phase transition. This is still a small system, but you see signatures of quantum phase transition in this model. We can also add control dissipation. And one important question is, how can we actually add dissipation to generate new kinds of entangles? Dissipation doesn't necessarily mean that it's a decoherent system. You can also direct the quantum evolution using control dissipation and many other. So with that, I thank you very much. I just started, so my graduate students, I'm still waiting for my graduate students to join me this fall. Right now I have a postdoc who is sharing with another group and a bunch of undergraduate students who are building some electronic circuits. Thank you very much.
Hey, great, thank you. So questions, comments? I wonder if I could ask if it seemed that the shortest range interaction that you would generate was 1 upon r cubed. And so is there a simple explanation for why that's the case?
So shortest range interaction, when I'm using only one frequency, one bit note frequency of the laser, so on the center of mass, like blue of the center of mass. And so there is an intuitive understanding, which is, so it's probably clear why if I am very close to the center of mass more, then it has to be long range,
yes,
right? Because it's
right.
Only center of mass. But if I am very, very far away from the center of mass mode, then the splitting between different normal modes doesn't matter. They almost take part equally. So I'm averaging over the effect over all different normal modes. So it's equivalent to as if your ion basically is oscillating individually, locally, because I'm averaging over all normal modes.
Yep.
So it's like dipole. That's kind of.
Oh, I see. Thank you. So, oh yes, right here, please, Andrews.
So, how many spins can you scale this up to in the near future, and what are the difficulties in doing that?
Yeah. So there are basically two kind of frontiers. So one is how many ions we can reliably trap in a trap and in a stable condition. That answer was about 25 or 30, even a few years back. And the reason why we can't go more is really a stupid technical problem, which is at room temperature, we cannot create a perfect vacuum or a very good vacuum. So what happens, because this is a highly charged object, so 25 ions in a line, if there is any background atom flying by, just a hydrogen atom, it can polarize the interaction. So if it has enough energy, it can destabilize the whole chain. So you're doing the experiment, and you will see the whole chain basically melting. And then we have ways to bring it back, but that's a practical problem. So that means that if we improve the vacuum, that will go much better, do much better. Unfortunately, that's kind of the technology of vacuum, and we're limited by that. But we can create a cryogenic vacuum chamber. So this is not the chamber in a dilution refrigerator, but there is a helium-4 system, basically a closed-cycle system, and it has basically a cold finger which is attached to the trap. So with that, at Maryland, they very recently, just a few weeks or just a month back, they managed to reliably trap and stabilize chain of about 120 ions. So that's one, how many we can reliably work with in this kind of trap. But having 100 ions does not mean that we can control 100 ions in a quantum coherent way. That's always a problem. So even in cold atom, neutral cold atom systems, in a BEC and optical lattice, yes, we can have thousands of atoms. But if you want to have control at the level of single particle, just like that was required for this entanglement entropy work from Harvard, we could only do that with up to 6 atoms. So that's a different question. And I think that frontier is about 20, depending on what you. If you want to do a full-scale tomography or full building up of entanglement, that number is somewhere around 14, 15. If you want to do some quantum simulation, like some non-trivial quantum simulation with long-range frustrated models, that's about 25. But no reason why that should not do better. So it's a matter of just classical control. A better laser, better optical power, better pulses.
Thank you.
Further questions? Well, if not, then please join me in thanking the speaker once again. Thank you. Thank you.